we're going to, well, obviously we're with the Gravel Gun podcast and two guys, two mics, talking some comics in comic book media. And what we want to do this week is continue our Icon series. And we spent a couple of weeks on Superman and had a whole lot of fun with that. And so now we want to go back, kind of move over and look at the other half of the comics universe. And specifically, Ben's probably favorite superhero, other than Batman, because, you know, yeah. Batman. But probably Ben's favorite superhero, Spider-Man. So, Ben, go ahead.
Yeah, well, this is actually primarily inspired by the fact that this month, August, 1962 was when the first Spider-Man comic debuted. So this is officially the 50th anniversary of Spider-Man, believe it or not. The old wall crawler's been at it for 50 years now. And it's actually, believe it or not, it's a pretty interesting story, even how it all began. Well, first of all, Spider-Man is ranked third on IGN's Top 100 Comic Book Heroes from back in 2011. We've been using that a lot.
I think Superman's number
right after Batman, right?
Right after Batman, right.
Yeah, yeah, number Superman, one, Superman, Batman.
Superman, Batman, Spider-Man. So there you go.
And essentially, as I was doing some research here, it kind of turns out that Spider-Man is basically effectively Marvel's Superman in a lot of ways. He's had a massive cultural impact. He has kind of represented the company in a lot of different ways. So it's pretty cool. And he really did, as I'm understanding it from reading, he really did, when he reviewed, kind of create a paradigm shift in the world of comics that kind of led into the Bronze Age and then up into the modern age of comics. So, yeah, let's dive right in.
All right.
Theoretically, and this is another interesting part of it, and I guess the official story is Spider-Man was created by Stan Lee and Steve Ditko. They were basically in need. Marvel Comics had just finished, had just kind of debuted the Fantastic Four. It was selling really well. And they were looking to break out into some different markets. They were just kind of finally establishing themselves as a comic book company in the, you know, at that point especially, very full, very competitive market of comic books. And they really wanted to break into the teen market. At this point, you know, this is the 60s. A lot of their readers who were kind of born right after the baby boomers in the 50s, late 40s and 50s were kind of growing up and still wanted to read comic books. And at this point, a lot of them were, you know, Archie comics were the big thing, and they were, you know, they weren't at that point just Archie comics, but they were mostly for teens and for young adults.
Let me interrupt you for one moment, Ben. If you are listening to this podcast and either are or know someone who is an Archie comics fan, please get in touch with us. We would like to put you on and let you explain that whole thing to the rest of the world, okay?
Yeah, not sure why that thing still exists.
So if you are into Archie Comics, if you follow them, if you enjoy them, please get a hold of us on our Tumblr. We'll put you on a Skype call because I really feel like the world owes me an explanation for that whole thing. All right, back to you, Ben.
Yeah, we totally need to have that happen. But actually, back in the day, Archie Comics actually had a ton of different titles as opposed to just Archie. But Archie was kind of their mainstream and kind of...
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you try reading... All right. If you think mainstream Marvel or DC is confusing to get into, trying to read the collected Wikipedia entries on Archie comics, yeah.
Someday we'll have to talk about the Archie and Punisher crossover.
Okay. All right. So next month, kids, we're doing an entire podcast where every single session is going to be crazy crossovers. All right, we're doing that.
Do that. We totally need to do that.
We are doing that. All right. I'm sorry.
No problem. But yeah, this was the 60s, the teens and especially youth culture is becoming a big thing. And Marvel looked out at the world and said, "Hey, you know, we need to tap into this market." So, as is typical of the entertainment industry, while it is full of artists, it also is full of businessmen. And they realized, "Hey, we need to tap into this market." According to Stan Lee, he basically was inspired by a couple different things. He said he was inspired by the pulp hero, The Spider, which I'm not particularly familiar with, but if I'm not mistaken, was pretty brutal, kind of noir-esque guy.
He's pretty terrifying. The dude has fangs. He shoots people. It's,
yeah.
It's pretty...
Yeah, he's a branding iron, right? He's like sears people's foreheads with his symbol.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. Although, so, to be fair, everybody was doing the branding iron thing back in the day. So,
yeah.
Which, makes me a little... It makes me question certain things about the culture in which that was... You know, it like probably that's one of those situations where I should not ask questions I don't want to know the answer to. But
pretty much, and yeah, I while Stanley says that, I have no idea how that ties into anything.
The word spider.
I guess the word spider. But then the next part is basically he says he saw a spider crawling on or flying on the wall. He was trying to think of a new character, and he saw this happening, and out of that he was born the desire this character idea. Now, he actually says in his own autobiography, Stanley says, he's not sure if that's actually the true story. He said it in hundreds of interviews, but he's not actually sure if that's actually the story, which is really funny, just because Stanley is kind of like that. He's going to say whatever.
That seems fair, you know.
Yeah. And actually, there's a lot of other creators who have claimed that they created the original concept for Spider-Man. A number of different ones have said that they created it for a previous publisher who never published it. And it was very in different regards. But the official, and they've never sued us or anything as far as I know, but the official story is that it was Stanley and Steve Ditko who came up with the character. And
sounds good to me.
Yeah, essentially. But apparently they took it to Martin Goodman, who was then the editor at Marvel, and he thought the concept was too generic. He was the typical studio executive type of person who basically looked at it and said, nah, that's never going to fly. There's way too many teen dramas out there, and you're just teen drama with a dash of superhero for taste. It'll never work.
And then he said, you know what we need? We need a dude in a giant purple helmet with horns who eats planets. That's what we need.
Exactly. So
this relatable teen, I mean,
after some editing, in which they basically, as I understand it, and this is also kind of nobody knows for sure exactly what happened, but apparently they changed some no-name editor somewhere in Marvel, changed the origin of Peter Parker's powers from a magic ring, which he found in his aunt and uncle's attic, to being bitten by a spider. It was published in the then-canceled, actually it was like in his last couple books, Amazing Adult Fantasy.
Ooh, that's a bad title.
That's what I was thinking when I read it. I was like, whoa, there's so many ways that could go so bad. But they actually recognize that as well. So in the issue they published the Spider-Man comics, they changed it to Amazing Fantasy, which is less creepy.
Yeah.
It doesn't make us think of the sex dungeons.
Yeah.
But it was actually a canceled comic, and so the basically Martin Goodman expected to die and expected never to hear about it again. And then as it happened, as the year into the year rolled around and they were looking at what was their top-selling stuff, he discovered that basically pretty much that one issue of Amazing Fantasy of his canceled book had basically outsold everything pretty much the entire year that Marvel had done. And he instantly looked at it and said, okay, we got to run with this. And in a couple months, in March of 1963, Amazing Spider-Man, the first issue, was published.
All right.
And it was massively popular. So popular to the point that during the 60s, Esquire magazine, which is not at all, don't really recommend, but it's a men's magazine, went to a bunch of campuses. They were looking at the new, you know, the revolutionary movement, the hippies, and the, you know, the socialist movement, the anti-Vietnam movement, and they basically said, who are your icons for this new culture? And they were basically, there were four of them. On the top four were Bob Dylan, Che Guevara, the Hulk, and Spider-Man.
Huh.
Yeah, and the reason being is because people finally found a character they related to. It was someone that they felt like had their issues and their struggles, and this was a very formative time in American history, and basically Spider-Man, kind of very much like Superman, it was basically a matter of timing. And a lot of people say that, you know, you could not launch Spider-Man today, you could not launch Spider-Man in 1980, you could not launch Spider-Man in 1950. This was the only time when it would have worked. Another big thing was basically Spider-Man was the first major teenage hero.
Yeah.
And, you know, previously they'd basically been relegated teenagers and relegated to sidekick status, like Bucky or Robin, Bucky being Captain America's sidekick, for those of you that might not know. And so basically it was a big deal. He was the first teenage hero. And interestingly enough, while reading up on it, that actually influenced the costume design as well, because they did not want to show his face because they wanted people to they didn't want people to recognize the fact that he was as young as he was. They didn't want that to be a fact that people could look at him right away and say, hey, that's a kid. Because the whole concept of Spider-Man was that basically they're using the concept of the idea of the superpowers and the secret identity to kind of discuss what it's like to be a teenager. In the sense that you don't know really who you are.
Because being a teenager is totally like that, except for the awesome superpowers and the secret identity.
Basically, yeah. But like I said, you're trying to figure out who you are. You're trying to figure out, you know, you're different in different circles. You know, you're different. You're one person at home and you're a different person at school. That sort of thing. And, you know, being a teenager is hard. And I think a lot of people make it harder on themselves than it needs to be. But it really resonated with people. One comic book historian kind of put it this way. People often glibly say that Marvel succeeded by blending superhero adventure stories with soap opera. What Stan Lee and Steve Ditko actually did in The Amazing Spider-Man was to make the series an ongoing novelistic chronicle of the lead character's life. Most superheroes have problems no more complex or relevant to their readers' lives than thwarting this month's bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
Parker had far more serious concerns in his life. Coming to terms with the death of a loved one, his uncle, falling in love for the first time, struggling to make a living, and undergoing crises of conscience. That was by Peter Sanderson, who's a comic historian. And that's totally awesome that we live in a world where you can have that job title.
yeah.
But he...
First world problems right there. So.
Exactly. But, so yeah, you have a character here who kind of completely changed the world of comics. And this is, if you remember, this is, what reminds me, 1963, we're in the Silver Age of comics, right?
I mean, late Silver Age, but yeah.
Late Silver Age, right. And essentially, what you'd seen up to that point was frequently like a villain of the month sort of situation. So Spider-Man kind of changed the whole world of comics and the way they were written. Just kind of like Peter Sanderson was just saying there, essentially it changed it from being a story about a guy with superpowers to a story about a guy with superpowers, in the sense that
yeah.
It wasn't much about the guy in the suit anymore as it was about the man in the suit. Am I being completely esoteric here?
No, it makes sense. It goes back to the paradigm we were talking about in the different treatments of Superman. You can either treat Superman as Clark Kent, who also happens to be Superman, or Superman, who is sometimes Clark Kent.
Exactly, and that's very much what Spider-Man was. And you see that kind of, according to a lot of historians, he was one of the first people who did that as a character, and they feel like that really did lead to some of the more soap operatic, drama heavy storylines that really kind of came in during the Bronze Age of comics. You know, the Silver Age was closing out, which was cheesy and fun and light, and then you hit a lot of the really heavy, grim stuff,
mm-hmm.
the Bronze Age and so on. And in a lot of ways, that's actually leads in really well to Spider-Man's storyline in general, which, unlike Superman, where it's a lot of, you know, huge world-changing arcs, Spider-Man's stories are pretty much centered around the fact of what the crap the writers can do to him next.
Yep.
Even starting with his origin story, he gets bitten by a spider. I mean, it doesn't start by, like, he... I guess in a lot of ways it's kind of like The Flash. You get hit by lightning. But
well, let's face it. None of these guys have nice origin stories, whether it's getting catapulted from your planet that just blew up or watching your parents shot down in an alley or getting struck by a bolt of lightning or...
Yeah, that's true. Even, I suppose, even Booster Gold has a crappy backstory.
You don't want to be any of these people. You just
don't. But yeah, so... If you're listening to this podcast and you don't know the backstory of Spider-Man, I don't know what to do with you.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing we can assume is that you're a new person who's also been inside, a nuclear fallout shelter for the last 20 years, and we welcome you back to the world. But there are probably more important things for you to do than to listen to this podcast. You know,
exactly.
I'm just saying.
But some of the major themes of Spider-Man, he got bitten by the radioactive spider, Then he basically has superpowers, and he's trying to find a way to make money off of them to kind of enjoy these powers. Ends up screwing up, being kind of a selfish douchebag. And then his uncle dies, and his uncle had always taught him, with great power comes great responsibility. And that kind of becomes a theme and a mantra for the rest of the Spider-Man stories, in the sense that no matter what, he can never really give up this Spider-Man persona, just because it's, you know, he has a responsibility to help people where he can, and he can help people in bigger, better ways as Spider-Man. And actually, just real quick, unlike a lot of other heroes, Spider-Man's powers haven't really changed a lot since his origin. They've added one or two, but they've almost always taken them away in short order, and they've also changed the explanation for them, but they've almost always remained the same. He has superhuman strength, speed, agility, stamina, reflexes, and endurance, so kind of the full physical package. He has a regenerative healing factor, which isn't as powerful as say, like the Wolverine. In fact, he usually ends up in the hospital, and he's just there less time than a normal person would be. He has the ability to cling to most surfaces, which initially they said was due to, like, the same thing that spiders have, where the little hairs that hook on everything.
And they decided that was dumb.
And creepy.
It's true.
And so they basically changed it to he actually has very limited control of gravitational fields around his hands and various parts of his body, so he can shift it to wherever he needs it. So
because that's definitely a very spidery thing to do, control gravity. So
yeah, they've in more recent years, sometime in the 2000s, and we might get to that. They basically kind of revamped his whole character into the fact that there is some sort of mystical spider thing going on with him. It wasn't just a random accident that he was chosen and that he's special and that these powers are. Yeah, specific to him.
Is Anansi the spider god involved? I'm just curious.
You know, I don't think so. I think there's a guy named Ezekiel who also has spider powers, and there's a whole bunch of African... Yeah, he travels to Africa and kind of has this reborn thing. There's also the whole Madame Spider? I don't remember.
Yeah, Madame Web or whatever.
Yes. The whole who basically... And you realize that his spider sense is... He has a spider sense, which is basically a precognitive, kind of momentary precog thing.
Which probably more than anything else in the Spider-Man mythos has made its way into pop culture. Whenever you think something bad is about to happen, you say, well, my spidey sense says.
Yeah, spidey sense is tingling, exactly.
Yeah.
He also has the ability to send sometimes. Sometimes this is physical, sometimes this is a gadget. He can shoot his webs. That's also pretty iconic for him. The web slinging. Sometimes, like you saw in the Sam Raimi movies, it's natural, and that actually happened to him at one point in the comic books, and then it got reset back to being his wrist gadget, like we saw in the most recent movie. He's also a genius-level intellect. Again, depending on the author. He's basically always been considered smart and a master of physical sciences, but not always a genius in the sense like Reed Richards or Tony Stark or Batman is. He's just really sharp, really intelligent. He's also list him here on the Marvel side as being a master hand-to-hand combatant. Again, this isn't really reflected very well in the comics. He gets the crap beat out of him all day long, which I guess is true of Batman too, except Batman also lays it out. But Spider-Man is his combat style tends to reflect the fact that he has webs and he can zip around really fast and he's really fast. As opposed to basically being able to sit there and deal out the pain like anybody else.
He spends a lot of time jumping.
He does, yeah. He's not the Hulk or the Thing, but he can lay down the pain. So, So, like I was saying, basically, all of his major story arcs that you've seen in the Spider-Man world have essentially, up until very recently, revolved around the fact that apparently the writers hate Spider-Man. They want... terrible things to happen to him at every possible turn. To the point where, you know, he starts out in high school and he is just, his uncle is dead, he's just trying to get by, and he's trying to help his aunt pay the rent. So he's half the time as Spider-Man, if you go back and read the comics, which I have, he is essentially trying to use his power to make money. in some fashion. It's actually kind of hilarious sometimes. He breaks in and beats up the Fantastic Four as sort of an addition to join the group, and he, of course, that doesn't go over that well. And then they come out, you know, we don't get paid to do this, right? And he's like, oh, crap, and then he leaves. it's pretty ridiculous.
Yeah.
But essentially you see him kind of doing that all along until he finally settles on working at the Daily Bugle and being able to take photographs for them. And is able to take these expensive pics of Spider-Man because he's the only person who can actually get them because he is Spider-Man. but at that point, you see him kind of trying to balance a lot of stuff in his life, his relationship with his aunt, his various girls he knows.
Say aunt again.
Aunt. Yeah, I don't usually actually say it that way. It's Aunt May, but I said aunt that time, so that was just for you.
You've been saying aunt all podcast. It's wonderful. Anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay, well, maybe I messed up that way. But he also, you kind of during this period, you kind of see him teaming up with a few different heroes, but not as much. Spider-Man is very much a street-level hero, kind of on the same sort of level as, like, Daredevil or Punisher or the Heroes for Hire, Luke Cage, and Iron Fist, and a few like that.
Dude, yes. That's not the Heroes for Hire anymore.
Yeah, I know. Heroes for Hire has gone crazy.
It's like Black Panther and what's the dude's name? Paladin.
Yeah, Black Knight and a couple of different ones. Yeah, but yeah, that's the traditional Heroes for Hire.
Sure. Yeah, I know.
It's kind of along that level of hero. Then he eventually goes and he gets into high school. Excuse me, into university and. Things get really heavy for the poor guy. Let's see here. Norman Osborn, the Green Goblin, figures out who he is, and he figures out who the Green Goblin is, and it all goes downhill from there.
Norman Osborn is just, generally speaking, a horrible human being.
He's essentially Lex Luthor with a lot less subtlety.
Yeah, that seems fair.
Yeah, he's kind of plays the same role, even to the point where he becomes president of the United States.
Or something akin to it.
Yeah. It's pretty ridiculous. But during the he's in university, and he gets into a serious relationship with Gwen Stacy, who is a major kind of player even in current times in the development of Spider-Man as a character.
Yeah.
Primarily due to the fact of what happens next, in the sense that. Something you really hadn't seen a lot of in comics up to that point happens to Spider-Man in the sense that you start to see a lot of collateral damage in the people and the lives around Spider-Man caused by his dedication to being Spider-Man. In the sense that while he's fighting Doc Ock, the police chief, Captain Stacy, rescues the little kid and gets crushed by the debris. That's something you see a lot of in, like, stories. In movies, you see a lot of, you know, falling debris, a lot of massive destruction, but you don't see a lot of people getting, you know, crushed or getting killed by
Right.
X. But that was something that started to come out in some of the Spider-Man stories. It was kind of a big deal because you were seeing this happen. And then they took it to the next level and had Green Goblin, who knew Peter Parker's identity, knew his relationship with Gwen Stacy. And in one of the most iconic stories in comic book history, hauls Gwen Stacy up to the top of the bridge, Washington Street Bridge in New York.
I haven't actually the foggiest idea. That sounds right, but
I'm pretty sure. I'm just checking here real quick. Brooklyn Bridge. It was the Brooklyn Bridge. Takes her up to the top of the Brooklyn Bridge and basically throws her off. And Spider-Man manages to snag her and reel her back in. When she reels her back in, she's dead. And for the longest time, there was a huge amount of debate among fans as to how she died. Did the Green Goblin kill her? Did she, die somehow during the fall? Had something else been going on? And the editors eventually came out and basically said, you know what killed her? And they go back panel by panel and explain it, was Spider-Man is actually catching her, and the whiplash broke her neck.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow.
Harsh, dude. Harsh.
I don't remember if they've actually ever had Spider-Man realize that's what killed her, But the fact that he killed somebody he loved, someone who was like the closest person to him at that point, while trying to save her, is just really,
really harsh. So, I mean, on that note, I'm pretty sure Batman would be killed by basically any time he's ever used a grapple gun.
This is true.
I'm just throwing that out there.
Yeah. But you don't usually see that being a problem for Spider-Man, in the sense that he's done this a half dozen other times and it hasn't killed anybody. But this time it killed Gwen Stacy and kind of ripped his heart out. The other big thing that you have in the Spider-Man series that you don't see as much of in other places, and it kind of became iconic for other things, is the use of clones.
Oh, good grief.
But Spider-Man is getting over the death of Gwen Stacy. He goes to Paris. He comes back, and he meets up with Gwen Stacy, who he knows is dead, because they want to rip poor Peter Parker's heart out and bash his head on the hood of every possible car in the area. And so he discovers that somebody has cloned him and cloned Gwen Stacy. Cloned Peter Parker with spider powers and Gwen Stacy. And, of course, things fall apart.
And then you find out the clone wasn't actually the clone, and...
Well, that's actually the second clone saga. Believe it or not, there's more than one of these.
Are you for real?
Totally for real. And actually, I think there might even be three total clone sagas.
Because I know there's a current clone who's now the Scarlet Spider, which, by the way, is on my list of books to start reading, if only because it's actually set in Texas.
Yeah, there's actually a couple of good Spider-Man spin-offs that have recently been really great. Venom and the other one.
Yeah.
So this is the first time he got cloned, and the Jackal is this scientist who makes clones. I'm not sure how he got to be called the Jackal. I'm guessing it's because this is like the 1970s, 80s, and you have...
Okay, now I've heard of the Jackal, and I mean, it totally makes sense because everybody associates Jackals with, you know, cloning experiments. So, I mean, yeah.
Probably also another thing we should realize at this point about comic books and about heroes is cloning was not very well understood at all. It was more of a concept than it was a reality.
Still probably isn't, honestly, but yeah. Yeah.
So effectively, in a lot of ways, people saw clones as essentially almost a part of that person. There's a scene in the Clone Saga where Spider-Man's fighting his clone, and he's basically saying, even if I survive this, you know, I'm going to die one way or the other, because one of his clones is going to die. So essentially, at this point in the scientific world, they basically see this, the clone is basically being a part of you.
Instead of just a genetic copy, but really a distinct and separate person.
And same, sure. Like this Gwen Stacy person that comes back, it's, you know, this is Gwen Stacy. And it's like, no, it's not. But in the comic books at that point, to them, that was effectively Gwen Stacy. Like, she had risen from the dead. And it's confusing, and it's kind of weird, and it makes it's kind of a little bit laughable now in current understanding of cloning and as it's become more and more of reality.
But I'm sure it was cutting edge at the time. Like, I'm sure if we'd been doing this podcast back in 1960, whatever, that you'd be like, dude, clones!
Exactly.
And I'd be like, clones!
Yeah, yeah.
And we'd be completely, like, our minds would be blown by this.
But...
So.
Now we've had Star Wars and everything else, and clones are very much...
We're just like, dude, clones again?
Yeah.
Like, come on.
Exactly.
I'm sort of curious, have we actually cloned Dolly the Sheep at this point in time?
Have we cloned the clone?
Like, Dolly, like, oh, well, no. I mean, like, have we done the Dolly the Sheep cloning bit at this point in time?
This is still in either this, I think, the late 60s or early 70s. So, no, Dolly has not been cloned yet.
All right, so we actually haven't cloned anything for real.
Basically,
so that makes this even, like, sketchier. Like, it's... Okay.
Yeah, even better. Once this Gwen Stacy clone and Spider-Man clone both get blown up in an explosion, Spider-Man then takes the... I guess the Gwen Stacy clone disappears. And then Spider-Man takes the corpse of his clone and buries it in an industrial chimney. Which is easily the grossest thing
because that's totally where I would put my extra bodies.
I'm like, yeah, some poor schmuck is going to go up there and try and clean out this chimney. It's going to have the worst day of his life.
He's going to get superpowers.
Poor Paul Spider-Man. Seriously. You live in New York. You can't think of a half dozen other ways to dispose of a body. But anyway, again, this is the 70s, and he's probably just in his early 20s. He's probably kind of panicking because he basically found his... Yeah, anyway.
Well, this is before everybody had watched enough CSI to know exactly how you're supposed to dispose of a clone body.
This is true.
Yeah.
Then we actually, shortly after this, we end up having basically Spider-Man, along with most of the rest of the Marvel Universe, in a major crossover event, gets sucked up by the Beyonder and sent to fight in the Secret Wars in outer space.
Secret Wars.
Not entirely sure what the deal with there is. That is, but basically his suit gets totally ruined and destroyed, so he uses some of the equipment there on the planet and makes himself a new suit, which is his black suit, which he, and believe it or not, this is more important than it sounds. He actually wears it for 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, it's actually a big shift, and it was highly controversial. A lot of the fans are really miffed at the idea that Spider-Man's wearing black. He's always wearing the blue and the red. He's Marvel Superman. It's American. He's an iconic, and now he's wearing black. What's the deal? So it was really controversial, which is probably why it ended up resulting in the famous Venom storyline.
Mm-hmm.
They need to explain basically why his suit itself had powers at that point, his space suit had powers, in the sense that he basically didn't have to carry around a backpack anymore. It basically just popped on him whenever he wanted it.
Which really is the way all super suits should work anyway.
True. Because you don't have time. You're like Flash. I have it in a ring on your finger right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, I need to suit up now. So, I mean, I totally get how that could definitely be an improvement.
Yeah. But so that they explain that, in fact, it's a symbiotic parasite type creature called Venom, who basically... Peter Parker has been for like the last 4 years, unbeknownst to all of us, struck fighting with it in kind of some sort of little psychic war, trying to regain control over it. And when he does, he basically kicks it off and it runs off and it's mad and has serious, serious breakup issues.
The Venom suit, and this is actually, believe it or not, this is actually a part of the Peter Parker Spider-Man continuity of which I'm actually fairly familiar. The reason being, there was this tremendously awesome Nintendo 64 platform game that I used to play at my cousin's house, and it was Spider-Man versus Venom. So I know the whole backstory here. And basically, Venom is like a creepy stalker boyfriend.
Yes. Yes.
Of the worst kind.
Who eats all the neighbors?
He just wants to be with you and use you to eat everyone.
Yeah, that's totally it. Yeah, it's totally weird and creepy. Effectively, this is also the first time, shortly after he gets rid of the suit, this is also the first time he asks to join the Avengers. This is totally horrible of them. They come back to him and say, no, you can't join the team because you damage team cohesiveness.
What? This is the Avengers. They take anybody.
And B, take anybody. And B, every other issue, they're beating the heck out of each other. I mean, they're fighting all the time. And they don't...
That is true.
Because he's going to damage team cohesiveness. It's like...
Really?
Douchey, guys. He's basically just saying, we're better than you. But so that was the first time. He tries to join at least twice more before they actually let him join. Then you have, again...
Which on some level probably helps to add to the whole charm of Peter Parker's life sucks, so...
Pretty much, he don't get no respect, so...
Yeah.
At this point, it's now reaching into the late 80s, and Spider-Man is in a long-term relationship with Mary Jane Watson, his lifelong love. Everybody knows it's him and Mary Jane are destined to be. And so he proposes in July of 1987. And again, this is a huge event in the comic book world. One of those things that ends up, you know, breaking out of the comic book world and being a huge deal in the media. Up to the point that, being typical Stan Lee, Stan Lee holds a mock Spider-Man wedding in Shea Stadium in New York.
Man.
yeah. That's
man.
Basically, a lot of people feel like Marvel, as ridiculous as it frequently is, and would never have worked without lovable Stan Lee, basically continuing to push the envelope in how awesome he thinks his characters are. and
I just wonder if there's someone in his life that pulled him aside at this point and was like, Stan, you can't do this anymore.
Really not, because he's built stuff like this. I mean, he still has it in his contract that he shows up in every movie that Marvel makes, right? The guy has to be seen. He loves his audience. So, yeah. Officiated at this mock wedding of Spider-Man and Mary Jane, where two actors pretended to be these characters. And all these fans came, and it was...
Wow. All right, so I just want to throw this out there, and I'm fine with this being on the internet because I want everyone to hold me accountable to this. All right, guys, if I ever go to the mock wedding of fictional characters for any reason, okay, I want someone to just hunt me down and kill me.
Yeah, I hear you, man.
I mean, that's, as far as I'm concerned, that is a notch or two below furry cosplay.
Well, except that probably at this point, most people who went to the wedding were probably little kids.
You know, I don't care. Yeah. I mean, basically, that's the sort of story that, you know, later on in life, like, you're sitting around the table talking about, well, I was this dorky when I did this, you know, and the dude is like, you know, well, I'm so dorky that I came up with an entire... original StarCraft game campaign based on the events of The Hobbit, hypothetically, if someone were to actually do that. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
And then he's like, oh, well, that's nothing. I went to Spider-Man's wedding.
And everybody's suddenly silent.
It's like, okay. And everybody just sort of inches away from you.
Yeah, exactly. So shortly after this, after he's married, you have the second clone saga.
Awesome.
Yes. And this is where we meet Ben Reilly.
Who is the Scarlet Spider now?
He's the Scarlet Spider, and who is a clone of him. You should, at this point also...
Wait, Ben Reilly is a clone of Ben Reilly, or he's a clone of Peter Parker?
Right. Don't make this more confusing, man. This gets freaky. And essentially, he discovers that he's been cloned. There's actually several spider clones. Some of them are pretty freaky. Some of them are massively huge. Some of them have, like, eight arms.
Which is sort of what you would expect from Spider-Man. It's always sort of disappointed me that Spider-Man did not have more arms.
Actually, early on, one of his earliest stories is he tries to quit being Spider-Man and makes himself a serum that will apparently eliminate his powers, but actually goes opposite way and gives himself eight arms.
Because that's totally how that would work.
Yes, it's actually totally freaky and awesome, and he gets the lizard, Kurt Connors, to help him out to get rid of all of his extra arms. But it's pretty funny.
Did the lizard eat them?
No, actually, Kurt Connors, when he's not the lizard, is actually pretty sane and normal.
Okay, because, I mean, if he was like, hey, lizard, I have too many arms, and the lizard was like, om nom nom nom, then that could have been a... You know, we're really podcasting too late at night, bro. I'm...
Yeah. But just as the clone saga is getting started, Aunt May apparently dies. If I'm not mistaken, she apparently dies. Shortly thereafter, Mary Jane and Peter discover that they're pregnant, and they move to Maine. And Peter tries to quit being Spider-Man. Ben Reilly, who is his clone, then becomes Spider-Man in...
Wait, but wasn't their whole thing where, like, Spider-Man's doing a bunch of really douchey things, and then they're like, oh, by the way, it was actually just a clone of Spider-Man?
That comes shortly thereafter.
Awesome.
Yes.
Sorry. Keep going.
Yes. Basically, at this point, they get pregnant. And Ben Reilly is become Spider-Man. He's kind of like, it's actually a lot like Azrael from the Azbat. From the
mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's not a very good Spider-Man. In fact, he's pretty bad at it, and he's actually, like you said, getting them into a lot, basically ruining Spider-Man's reputation just by being bad at being Spider-Man. But he's actually Spider-Man for quite a while. A lot of people,
but you don't know it's Ben Reilly, or do you?
Oh man, I don't know. And actually, this comes from the fact that I have not.
See, the impression I'd always gotten was it's like the whole. Oh, and by the way, they moved to Maine, and it was all a clone. Was like an after thing because everybody hated who the new Spider-Man was.
You're actually right, and that's probably one reason why this is so confusing to me is because I don't know what actually happened here. But as part of this storyline, basically, Mary Jane and Peter have a baby. They go to the hospital, and they think the baby dies, which is terrible and sad and really crappy the writers to do. But again, because they're doing this whole weird retcon thing with Ben Reilly, you later discover that, no, the baby has not died, and in fact, the Green Goblin has stolen it.
Of course.
Yes. yeah. So
does the baby have eight arms?
No, the baby, as far as I know, is completely normal, and I really do not know what happened to the baby. I kid you not, I cannot figure out what happened to the baby. I have looked.
Huh. Okay, so Marvel fans out there, if you're listening,
tell us what happened to little.
We need a little help with this clone, with this whole clone shenanigans.
Yeah, I like Spider-Man. In fact, Richard said he's my favorite Marvel character. I would read Spider-Man probably, and this is going to sound terrible, probably over Superman or Justice League comics any day if I had to choose between them. But there's certain parts of it, like the Clone Saga and whatever happened to Little May Parker, that are blowing my mind, and I don't know what's going on here.
Yeah.
So I do know that they do figure out who's the real Peter Parker. Okay, in the second.
That's clone, handy information.
I can tell you this. Basically, Peter is convinced at some point that he is in fact the clone. And that
right. See, this I remember, like that the clone Spider-Man is off living with Mary Jane, and the actual Spider-Man is being Spider-Man, and then everybody hated the actual Spider-Man, and so then like, hey, wait a minute, actually, the real Spider-Man who is not the clone Spider-Man is actually the clone Spider-Man, and the Spider-Man who thinks he's the clone is actually the original Spider-Man.
It kind of had to happen, otherwise it's totally creepy.
Well, I mean, I.
Wait, you could.
I mean,
thing you could do with clones.
Yeah, yeah. So we're gonna leave Spider-Man there this week, all right? And we're gonna come back to him next week with some additional clarity. If we have to go dig, we're gonna go dig up some back issues this week. We're gonna come back next week with some additional clarity on this Clone Saga thing because it's gonna bother me.
Yeah, and actually, it's a great place to stop because basically, right next, we start to get into the modern era of Spider-Man.
In which there's another clone? Yes?
Yeah, there are several other clones. And the spider awesome. Thing, which happens actually only happened a couple years ago, there's a
which
big
is like everybody gets spider powers. So, yeah.
Spider-Man. So.
All right. Well, and at that point, we're going to go ahead and leave our icons segment for this week. And next week, we'll return with some more Spider-Man and clones.
All right. Sounds like a plan.